good horse, I called you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune, to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And this we go riding.
You're listening to episode 543 of Unwelcome Guests, The Corruption of Money. I'm Robin Upton, and that title is the title of a PowerPoint presentation that I made last year, and it's available online. If you'd like to download it, that will help you get the most from this week's show. Its address is altruists.org. That's altruists.org/AE606. That's AE for Altruistic Economics, and it's presentation number 606. So, in approximately 20 minutes, I will start the radio adaptation. So if you can download it between now and then, that may help. We'll also be hearing a few words from George Lakoff, the psychologist, and prison reformer Vivian Stern on how money and the market mechanisms have distorted people's ideas of justice and morality. To get us started, this is the first half of a presentation by the great John Taylor Gatto from approximately a decade ago. This is called Beyond Money.
I've had an opportunity to meet many of you and once again to be inspired by the tremendous talent that seems locked up away from the instruments of power, from any voice in this school nightmare we have, but it's very reassuring that eventually we'll get out of this. I'd also like to give you a plug for something I read last night. There's a lady here from Canada who's the editor of just a grand magazine called Natural Life. So there's an unsolicited plug for Natural Life. And finally, I'd like to dedicate this morning's talk to a great American family who's been an inspiration to me now for 3 years and to thousands of other people around the country, Day and Pat Ferenga, who spoke here, and their kids. I think they're the best of what America's made of. So this farewell, this valedictory, will be a little bit about my mother. My mother took in stray animals, mostly homeless dogs and cats, but if a hurt bird's wing needed repair, birds also. And if a turtle was crossing the road too slowly, she made my father stop the car so she could get out and carry it to the other side of the road. When Dad objected to how many animals our household was supporting, Mother took to setting large dishes of Nabisco dog food in our backyard for the wanderers. It was an act of generosity that made our house look like a kennel and drove my father frantic, not least because he was the manager of the local National Biscuit Company, and so the supply of dog bones was endless. The other day I was reading Proverbs, a collection of advice set down by King Solomon 3,000 years ago, and I came across these words: speak up for those who cannot speak for themselves. Speak up for those who cannot speak for themselves. Suddenly I realized what my mother had done all those years that I thought she was just feeding animals. She was speaking up for those who could not speak for themselves. And reading further into Proverbs, I found this line: happy are they who are generous to the poor. And reading those words, I realized I had part of the secret that made my mother happy. For she was happy most of the time I was growing up, in spite of having a full share of her own troubles. She was unfailingly generous, not just to outcast creatures, but to anyone who came to our door for a handout, to any neighborhood person fallen on hard times and needing help. I had a little lawn mowing business in those days. I was about 13. And I remember in particular the widow with young children whose lawn I mowed for free because my mother asked me to. I resented that at first, but after a while I came to love it. I suppose I read Proverbs the way most people do who pick up a Gideon Bible in a motel room. I jump about not looking for anything in particular. So it was while randomly turning the pages at one of the 260 motels I've stayed at in the last 3 years that I found this judgment, and by implication, this warning too. There is joy for those who seek the common good. When I hear that, I remember my mother's beautiful Christmas trees that took her days of hard effort to create as she sought her family's common good. I remember her collecting kitchen grease and metal scrap for the war effort in the long gone days of World War II for the community's common good, and her fierce defense of equity as the head of the school's PTA, her founding of a Cub Scout troop when nobody in Monongahela who was male could be persuaded to do so. I remember the joy she brought to so many undertakings in my boyhood as she pursued the common good. The London Economist announced recently that 70% of all the lawyers in the world are in the United States. We have 25 times the number of lawyers per capita that Japan does, 3.5 times the number that England does, 2.5 times the number per capita of Germany. If you add our public and private practice lawyers together, about 1 in every 250 Americans is a lawyer. What could the meaning of this be? 70% of all the world's lawyers. Before he died, Joseph Campbell, the myth man, took note of our enormous legal fraternity, and he called it the way Americans talk to each other, the way employees talk to their bosses and brothers talk to their sisters. Lawsuits are the way we get the other guy's attention because we have lost a normal interest in each other, lost our concern for human face-to-face justice, lost the taste for plain speaking that marks a healthy people. Looking at the great tradition of English common law, there are only two reasons to bring a legal case at all. First, that someone hasn't kept a promise, has not done what they said they would do. That gives rise to contract law. And second, that someone has encroached on another person's rights and done harm, and that gives rise to tort and criminal law. So if you're looking for a new way to mark the crisis in American society, if you're wary of hearing about teenage suicide, weary of hearing about teenage suicide, divorce, crime, violence, alienated brothers and sisters, murder, drugs, even one more time, then think on the barometer of crisis represented by 70% of the world's lawyers collecting under the American Eagle's wing. There must be a tremendous number of us breaking our promises, a tremendous number of us encroaching on rights to support such a horde of barristers. We are forgetting, I think, how to live together in families and in communities, forgetting the necessary personal duties that make families and communities in the first place. In a rush to get out from under personal responsibility, to escape. How often do you hear the cry, let them do it, they get paid for it? I certainly hear that cry every day in New York City. Them can mean the police or the street sweepers or the social workers or any of the other number of occupational titles that have come into being only recently. We live for 200 years and more in this country without police. How was that managed? These occupations signal our transition from a world of human beings who live together and care about each other to a world of institutions and hired hands, a world of agents instead of principals. What does it mean that we break promises so often that an army of lawyers can earn fine and, of course, unregent supervised livings punishing them? What does it mean that we encroach so often on each other's rights, that an army of lawyers is needed to seek redress? How did the country survive so well its first 200 years without police or without many lawyers? When we abandon personal responsibility for the common good, which Solomon urged us not to do, what does it signify? What does it mean for your future and mine that a price tag is set on simple services that through the long history of humanity were freely exchanged and freely given, like sitting with the sick, caring for the old, even caring for one's own children, or like mowing a poor widow's lawn? If it means something frightening to you, as it does to me, then what can we do about it? At the turn of the 20th century, a profound social thinker in France named George Simmel wrote a remarkable book called The Philosophy of Money. In it, Simmel, one of the great creative theorists of this or any other century, said that money contained within itself a powerful internal contradiction, and it was built into the foundations of its abstract existence. This contradiction, it could not be gotten rid of. He said that money robs things of their innate identity and replaces that core identity with a money identity. By making everything interchangeable with money, money often cheapens things and removes their significance. Simmel said that whenever genuine personal qualities like service were offered for money, that the pricing of these things inevitably trivialized the service which had been priced. Such services tend gradually to become degraded. They're never as good as they are in the first few years they're offered, to lose distinction just exactly as if the money itself sharply reduces the value of what is being purchased. Now, even though that was written over 90 years ago, it still has a shocking, an almost crazy ring to it. But Simmel was quite serious, and generations of blue ribbon readership have found enough disturbing truth in his words to keep them available generation after generation. Simmel also said, whenever genuine personal values have to be offered for money, one finds that a loss of quality in individual life takes place. So not only does the service decline in quality, but that the life that gives and purchases that service declines in quality also. For instance, in prostitution, which is a limited kind of temporary marriage for sexual purposes and for money, the monetization of sex leads, according to Simmel, to a terrible degradation of personal value on the part of the prostitute and on the purchaser of the service. Both prostitute and client are worse for the experience, not better. The sale of compassion is in welfare work. The sale of concern, even the sale of a helping hand in many instances, leads to the same destination. At some point, pricing eats away the intangible quality of service, and the central value of what is offered is destroyed. It's a complicated idea, but one well worth musing upon. It's a subtle idea that requires not an instant rejoinder, not an opinion in response, as might be asked for in a school classroom, but a long period of reflection before you decide where you stand in regard to that.
Well, in lieu of a period of reflection, we're having a change of speaker. This is a cue to introduce an audio adaptation of the presentation I made last summer, 70 slides, on the corruption of money. Now, if you still haven't found this, you could try Googling on AE606. That's the number of the presentation. If you don't feel like opening a computer, or if you're not near the internet, doesn't matter. I'll be describing the salient features of most of the slides anyway. This is, to some extent, an attempt to synthesize a lot of what we've had on the show into one easy presentation, and it does oversimplify certain matters of necessity. This isn't a complicated look at the details, such as we heard from Bernie Sanders last week. The aim is to see what is so difficult to grasp for those of us who've grown up in a moneyed society, that it doesn't have to be this way, and that pricing things and attaching a tag to everything has a lot of deleterious effects for most people, while still being in few people's short-term selfish interests. Now, let's get started. It's a presentation in four parts. I'm going to start by going over some fundamental ideas. If you remember George Lakoff's idea of the strict father as opposed to the nurturing parent, then that's going to get us started. Then I'm going to be looking at personal corruption, how the existence of this thing which was called money, and the fact that people who are selfish are rewarded, and non-selfish impulses in the money system get punished. I'm going to look at personal corruption. Then I'm going to look a level out. I'm going to look at social corruption in a society full of people with different tendencies. What does it do to society if the most selfish are systematically rewarded and the most altruistic are punished in terms of their influence in the money system? Finally, we're going to be looking at global corruption. If societies are of various kinds and some are more predatory in nature than others, then will this help us understand how global institutions such as the IMF, the World Trade Organization, the American military, will this help us understand how certain large institutions, predominantly Western-backed, have come to dominate? So what is called globalization is a building of a hierarchy with a few institutions of a certain nature at the top. Now, fundamental ideas. I'm going to look at how money works on a fundamental level. I'm going to look at the financial world view, what it means to see the world through the lens of money. I'm going to contrast Lakoff's ideas of parenthood, and we're going to have a note about psychopathy. So, this is called the corruption of money. What is corruption? It has different meanings. If a computer file is corrupt, it doesn't mean it's missing. It just means that it's missing some parts of it. It's lost its integrity, so it's not going to work the way that it should work. Corrupt people, I suggest, are also lacking integrity. They're not pursuing their own goals. They may be corrupted by something, such as money in particular, and in so doing, they're having another agenda which is working through them. Corrupt organizations, as I'm defining it, and corrupt in the sense that they don't pursue their stated goals. Now, let's look at the very basic points about money, things that is so simple and so well understood that it passes without comment. Firstly, banks define what money is, and if the banks define that what you have is acceptable, other people have to accept it, and you can swap it for stuff. So the take-home message, which you learn from about the age you want to get some sweets and mum gives you some money, is the more money you get, the more you can get of whatever you want. Now, we know every purchase has a buyer and a seller. So somebody who receives money, the winner, if you like, and somebody who has to give the money, the loser. So what's the take-home message? Life is full of winners and losers, and less for you means more for me. Now, that seems obvious in terms of money, and it is in terms of material goods, but note that it's not true in terms of software. If you use the software that I'm using, neither of us loses out, and in fact, it might be a bonus. Certainly not true in terms of love. So if your thoughts are heavily influenced by money, you go around thinking, well, life is full of winners and losers, you can project that view onto what you see, but it doesn't necessarily mean that that's the way things have to be. And if you have money, you learn that you may wish to give it away, but the more you give away, the less you have. Now, we're going to stop there for a couple of sections of an interview. This is a rebroadcast from episode 345 with prison reformer Vivian Stern on what she calls the commodification of justice. And in the first part, she's talking about how justice, which used to be understood, required, and to which everybody should contribute, like a lot of other social goods and services, has increasingly been reinterpreted in a market framework.
The other thing you mentioned was this idea of the commodification of justice. Can you tell us more about what you mean by that?
Yes, that's also quite complicated. Certainly we're seeing in this society, and I imagine it's happening elsewhere, a transformation of people from citizens to consumers. And then a new way of looking at our public services, which is not that they are provided by all of us through our taxes for all of us, and we share them, and we try and ensure those who need them most get them, but they are much more analogous to going shopping, and people should have choice, and they should look more like the sort of things you get when you go shopping, and you should fight to get the best for yourself. In the past, there was more an idea that they were shared, and we all paid for them, and we all were part of them.
Now, we're going to get on to George Lakoff in a few minutes, but suffice it to say for now that what she's just spoken about is pretty much the definition of the nurturing parent, that everybody in society needs this thing that's called justice, and everybody should be prepared to contribute to it. This is as compared to what Lakoff calls the strict father, who needs to be tough, whose analogue is market discipline, where self-maximization is the only rational behaviour, and where self-maximization means other minimization. Reflect, as she continues to speak, on where this idea came from, that for me to get justice, for me to get something good, someone else has to get punished. Someone else has to suffer something negative. Is that perhaps an echo of the internalized market process? Do people think that way because the money world works that way?
Now, when this is done to justice, it's hard to see what it is you're going to give people. You're going to try and give people safe streets and make sure their cars aren't broken into, their houses aren't broken into. But what has happened very, very noticeably in the last 10 or 15 years is to re-describe justice as something that you get when someone else has been punished for what they did to you. And that is now what the word justice means in a lot of the discourse in England, and I'm saying England very deliberately because Scotland is a devolved country which has a very different view of the world. But in England, there will be a lot of talk about they're entitled to justice. And this justice is not justice for all of us. Well, the just outcome might be that the person isn't punished. The just outcome might be that the person gets some health care. The just outcome might be that the person gets a lot of help from the welfare system. But when justice is reduced to an individual commodity, it is then described as a punishment inflicted on the perpetrator. And when that's happened, you've got your justice. So it's an individualization. It's seeing each person as a customer or as an individual economic unit, and you're entitled to something, and the state will give you this, and they will give you a certain amount of punishment. And it seeps into everybody's thinking, and people who have been victims of crime saying, I didn't get my justice, and I want my justice, and I felt I got justice because he got 10 years or 12 years. But of course, it's not an individual relationship. It is actually something, justice is for all of us, and can't really be broken down in that way. But that has become the driver of how punishment is allocated and the driver of the discourse in the media about how cases are dealt with.
And we see this zero-sum mentality all over the place. There's a Bengali proverb that says, you can only eat so much rice. After a point, everybody will start sharing the things they've got. But of course, that's not true with money. Whatever fraction of money you have, you can always try and get more, get people into greater and greater debt. Witness the actions of the bankers at the top of the system in last week's show. It is an addiction, and it's because scarcity and fear has driven people from satisficers to maximizers. I believe that impulse does encourage people not to be generous, not to share. That impulse promotes hoarding, and in so doing, when you say, why are you hoarding your stuff? We could use that better than you could. Then, if somebody tries to defend that argument, that strengthens their conception of the discrete and separate self. Another very basic point about money, you are not allowed to create it. You're not a bank. It's their system. Money comes from satisfied employers, so you keep the boss happy, you'll get your salary, or possibly the customer. But what this teaches you is that bosses must be kept happy. As an amateur, you can't get this stuff. You can't create money. You might be able to do whatever you like. You've got to get this by keeping the boss happy or by going into business, either of which is involving the system. Now looking at the world view of economics. I said money is a one-dimensional shadow of the real world. And what do I mean by that? Whatever you care to name in terms of objects, whether it's a house, a car, a cocktail, or even elements of the natural world, like a tree, these, to the economist, are all reducible to a single dimension, how much something is worth. What's the cost of polluting a stream, maybe negative or positive? You might have to pay, or you might get this if you own that item, but economics only sees the numbers. So any amount of myriad distinguishing qualities that these items might have are indistinguishable when you look at the economic impact. If something isn't bought and sold, it's unnoticed. So economics looks at somebody who has no money, no income, and is living, say, in New York City, not in great affluence, with somebody, say, who is living in the back of beyond, growing their own food in a gift economy, and says, well, these two people are equally poor because that neither of them has money. And in spite of attempts to modify their definition of poverty, this is still how development agencies tend to regard poverty, because they can't get a handle on things which go beyond numbers. This map shows you the worldview of the economist. This is countries sized by GDP. For radio listeners, there's three huge blobs: North America, Western Europe, Japan, and South Korea, each of which looks hugely swollen compared to the geographical map. And Africa is almost completely missing, and the rest of the world is pretty small. So if you wish to go into business, ask yourself, is it worth feeding Africa? Is it worth innovating for the third world? Well, if they don't have any money, it's not worth it, by the economist's definition. So no wonder people in Africa are growing flowers and exporting them to Europe or the rest of the world, because Europe, North America, Japan and South Korea have a lot of money to pay for things which people in third world countries don't have. So if you're a profit maximizer, it doesn't make sense to try to sell to a local market which doesn't have money. Now we're going to compare two different ideas of fatherhood. This is the strict father, as exemplified by the quote, survival of the fittest, survival of only the fittest. And this idea keeps coming up in this presentation, so rather than having my potted summary, I thought, let's recall Unwelcome Guest episode 505, what George Lakoff had to say on strict father mentality.
Conservative ideology, in general, and a certain view of morality, which I'll call strict morality. It goes like this. There's a difference, by the way. It's a gendered system. Daddy is different from mommy. You gotta have both. It's gotta be a gendered system. Why do you need a strict father? Because there's evil out there in the world and he's gotta protect the family from evil. Because there's competition out in the world. There will always be winners and losers. He's gotta be a winner to support the family. Because children are born bad in the sense that they just want to do whatever feels good. They don't know right from wrong. And you need a strict father to teach them right from wrong. So you need a strict father to teach your kids right from wrong. How do you do it? Well, Dobson says there's only one way, punishment when they do wrong, and maybe reward when they do right. It's a sort of behaviorist system. And the punishment, he says, must be painful enough so that the child will want to discipline himself or herself to do the right thing to avoid the punishment. That's the idea, to get internal discipline to avoid the external discipline. And Dobson, by the way, is one of the more liberal people on this matter. He says that you should never hit a child under the age of 15 to 18 months. There are other authors who have it earlier, like from birth. Now, if a child is disciplined, that's the only way a child becomes a moral being, through such discipline. And if the discipline occurs, there's an extra bonus. What's the bonus? The bonus is they can then pursue their self-interest to become self-reliant and prosperous. That is, there's a link between morality and prosperity. The same discipline that allows you to be moral. Morality is seen as obedience to a moral authority, God or the strict father at home. That the same discipline that allows you to be obedient to a strict father is the discipline that allows you to become prosperous. And there's a logic here. Suppose you're not prosperous. Then you're not disciplined enough. And if you're not disciplined enough, don't have the discipline to be moral. So you deserve your poverty. And that has social implications. Now, another major part of this model is that after a child has grown and become mature, if they have gotten the self-discipline, they can go out in the world and take care of themselves. If they haven't, if they're still dependent and haven't been sufficiently disciplined, then they also should go out in the world. They receive, by the way, the name for this discipline is called tough love. There's a word for it. They have to go out in the world and be disciplined by the world. And if they can't make it, too bad. Okay? But by the time they're adults, that's what they should be. Now, there's another part of this. Why is it moral within this system to pursue your self-interest? And Dobson is very clear about this. This is a version of Adam Smith's view of capitalism. The idea in at least the popularized version of Adam Smith is actually a more complicated thinker than that, is that if everybody pursues their own profit, then by the invisible hand, as a law of nature, the profit of all will be maximized. So it's good to pursue your self-interest because you're helping everybody else.
So strict father will see America, because it's the richest, as the most righteous. And yes, Europe is educated, Japan, South Korea are hard-working, so those people who have money deserve money. If the third world is poor, it's because they're overpopulated, they're fundamentalist, Africans are lazy, so they deserve to be poor. Contrasting idea, the nurturing parent, and if you've got the presentation in front of you,
This is the yellow smiley face as opposed to the red angry face, exemplified by the quote, "What goes around comes around." The first duty of parents is to protect their kids. Kids should learn to be responsible for other people, learn to have empathy, and society should provide for all its members according to their need. So, looking at the world through the eyes of the nurturing parent looks at North America, Europe, and Japan and says, why are these places consuming so much of the world's resources? These places are greedy. What about Africa? Very needy. Rest of the third world, also needy. They're not getting as much as they deserve. Now, psychopathy. Refer to episode 90 of the Corbett Report, an excellent show called Our Leaders Are Psychopaths, if you haven't already heard of psychopathy. It's a mental deficiency. It affects about 1% of people, and it causes them to lack a conscience. So just as somebody is born blind or deaf, certain people are born without a conscience. And it's actually not that easy to spot, because psychopaths quickly learn to pretend they have a conscience. They don't feel guilt, and they behave selfishly with no check on their behavior. They're very good at lying convincingly, because there's no part of their brain tells them they shouldn't lie. They live, generally have a parasitic lifestyle, and they ruthlessly seek power over others. They're not capable of empathy and the loving relationships which the other 99% of humanity enjoy, and in their worldview it's kill or be killed. So they seek to have power over others. I'm going to make the general case in this presentation that the money system on its own terms is basically psychopathic, and that this is no accident, because psychopaths control the system and they're using the system as a means to normalize their own behavior. They're trying to teach the rest of the world their set of values, behaving as seems normal to them, and whilst selfishness, lying, parasitism is understood by pretty much every culture that I know around the world to be not the way you should do things, in the money context, this is nevertheless the way that people are encouraged to behave. And money facilitates and excuses a life of parasitism. This is a quote from Frédéric Bastiat, a 19th century economist. Quote, "When plunder becomes a way of life for a group of men in a society, over the course of time they create for themselves a legal system that authorizes it and a moral code that glorifies it." Unquote. So if you've ever wondered quite why there is so much adulation of the super rich, that is part of the process of glorifying those who do the most plundering. So that was the first section. Second section, having established certain broad definitions, looking at personal corruption. Now, people naturally operate on ground of a range of motives. I'm going to suggest that money encourages selfishness and psychosis. And by psychosis, I mean not seeing the world as it is. So money corrupts people's thinking, because if you focus just on money, you're ignoring other value systems. And money is a very simple system, one number, one dimension of understanding, and you want the most. Underneath a lot of complex maths, it comes down to self-maximization. We can hear certain phrases like, "How much is he worth?" which make clear that somebody's equated to a certain amount of money. And if we hear about compensation, that's something that has come in my lifetime, universal application of money to try to balance the equation, if you like. If you break your leg because of someone else, then they pay you a certain amount of money, and you don't need to say financial compensation. Pretty much any compensation is financial compensation. So the hidden lesson here is that anything can be expressed in money terms, which, of course, is an oversimplification when we stop and think about it. And this is a picture from an advert for a company called GE Capital. Georgs Marienhütte makes the steel flow. GE Capital makes the cash flow. And we have, looks like, one industrial engineer and one bank manager looking over a forge with some obviously molten steel getting pressed into ingots or something. I mean, the advert is a very worked-out image. It's putting forward a message which a lot of people have spent a lot of time crafting. So it's worth looking at adverts. I've been looking at bank adverts, trying to understand what message they're putting forward. And this is the message I can see. If you've looked at money, you'll know that banks create money out of nothing. It's an accounting entry. They just type something into a keyboard. And this is obviously very different from how other people get money. We have to work for our money. We have to borrow it, in fact. So why are they trying to put this image forward? Well, they make the steel flow, we make the cash flow. They're making it look like there's an equivalence there. You know, it's not easy job to make steel flow. You've really got to put in a lot of effort. So they're making it look like they're putting in a lot of effort as well. And they're trying to strengthen the metaphor in people's mind that money is a resource, that it's a scarce resource. And in fact, that's completely wrong. Banks make money out of nothing and have huge advertising budgets to try and hide that fact. And in spite of all this palaver that in the UK at least has been going on about bank bonuses and are they being paid too much and so on, I haven't seen anything in commercial media about the fact that banks make money out of nothing and then charge interest on this. And is this a rather unfair way to do things? Why do they talk about flowing? Well, if something is flowing around, then it's zero sum. So if it flows from me to you, you've got it, but I haven't got it. The only reason money works like that is because it's an analog of gold coins. If we wish to work money differently, we could do so tomorrow. Designs exist for this, such as the altruistic economics model that I put forward several years ago. Here's another advert for the same company. It's a picture of a guy working on a motorbike. The new Triumph Thunderbird, engineered with passion, power, and finance from GE Capital. So it's emphasizing the same thing again. You've got a desirable-looking motorbike, and to make it, you don't just need passion and power, you need finance from GE Capital. So if you really need money, and banks are the only way you can get money, then the bank is doing the production in part. This is my favorite one of the adverts from a bank I was in a couple of years ago. It says, "It's money's turn to work hard for you." Now, that kind of assumes that you have worked hard for your money, so your money should work hard for you. That sounds fair, doesn't it? Except, what is that saying? Money is working hard for you? So that suggests money has an ability to do work. And you're thinking, well, it's getting me interest. That's what work is. Work is anything that creates money. Well, maybe the rich like to think that their money is working for them. But, of course, money can do no work. If I'm lending you my car or a tool of some kind, something that can help you work, then I'm without that for a certain period of time while you've got it. So you might think it's acceptable if I levy a charge of some kind. Whereas when the bank lends you their money, they've created it out of nothing. So they're not losing out in any shape or form. So what moral right do they have to charge you for that experience? I would say none at all, and that's why they're trying to take this idea of fairness and pervert it. You work hard for your money works hard for you. This is going to come as a surprise to any economists, if any economists are listening to the show. In 1973, and this is not an economics research, this is a sociological result that turned up, that is, of course, very relevant to money. In 1973, US blood bank asked former donors whether they'd like to donate again, and half of them were asked exactly that question, would you like to donate blood again? And 93% of that half said yes. And the other half were asked, would you like to donate blood again? We will reward you $10 if you do. And what do you think was the result? It was 93% wanted to when asked a simple question. When offered a $10 reward, that 93 went down to 65%. I wonder why that is. I'm explaining it here by saying that money crowds out other motives. When you frame it as an economic transaction, which happens the moment money pops up, people think, $10, is it worth it? Well, I'd have to go to the blood bank, and then I'd be without blood, and that'd be a hassle. Maybe it'd be a risk. When people evaluate it in terms of how much is in it for me, then they're thinking selfishly, and that is the natural response to introducing money into the framing. Those who are not thinking about it in those terms ask themselves, do I believe in the concept of donating blood? Is it nice to think that if I needed blood, there would be blood for me? Am I going to lead by example? So when money is involved, people behave more selfishly. This is a big problem for almost everywhere in the modern world, especially, of course, in the so-called developed countries, the most monetized countries, and we are seeing the result in terms of huge increases in depression. In spite of material affluence, there is what you might consider a spiritual poverty that abounds wherever money is very prominent in society, because people frame things in selfish terms and they end up fighting one another for money. This is, of course, nothing new. From the Gospel of Matthew, no man can serve two masters. You cannot serve both God and money. If you follow money, then you will do whatever pays the most. And, of course, that is going to subvert whatever you believe in. People don't generally pay you lots of money for doing things you were doing anyway. They pay you for doing things you don't want to do. Now, another experiment. This is 2009. This is about the power of money to affect people's sensory perceptions. Two groups of people put their hand into hot water. They rated the pain from 0 to 10. Half of them, just before they put their hand into hot water, were counting banknotes. Half of them were counting pieces of paper. So how do you think that affected their understanding of the pain? Well, would you be surprised to hear? Think about Scrooge. Think about rich people counting their money, to hear that the group who counted the banknotes felt less pain than those who counted the paper. How can money act as a painkiller? Why did touching that money reduce people's subjective understanding of the pain? Well, even thinking about money makes people feel independent, strong, selfish, and valued. So, to summarize, money reduces people's desire for friendship. They did another version of the same experiment where they exposed people to a feeling of social isolation and discovered the effect was much stronger. For money is a painkiller when people were already sensitized to feeling social exclusion. So in other words, money substitutes for social connections. So it's not only your imagination that tells you that poor people are better people in the sense that they are more oriented to one another, because this is how they live. And this is how people generally do live, without money, which tells them something different from what their heart tells them. Money tells them the more money they've got, the easier life is. How do you get money off other people? So in that sense, it's a competitive thing. Now we're going to look at how money affects the language. Modern languages are full of revealing money metaphors. So the first one, don't bank on it. means don't rely on it, as if banks are the most trustworthy places. What does it mean to say, I am broke? It means I don't have money. How does that equate to being broke? Well, all of this language strengthens the idea that money is strength, which, of course, is an agenda that certain people, viz. The rich, would like others to think. So that suits their view of the world, and being rich, they control the mass media, which, before the internet especially, gave them tremendous power over the language to which other people were exposed. What does it mean to talk about the cost of living? Well, it's like standard of living. It's very materialistic, but the cost of living sort of implies that life itself costs money. So then by implication, if you haven't got any money, well, what are you doing living? And this has the psychosis of money symbol next to it, meaning this is a reflection of our thinking. Language comes from people's thought patterns. So you hear somebody say you get what you pay for, then that sort of implies you only get what you pay for, and implies that money is a measure of quality. What does it mean to say every man has his price? Well, it suggests that people, like things, can be bought. How many times did you hear the phrase, time is money? It's funny how that one never seems to come up in Bangladesh, because people have been taught from a very early age that they are in a poor country, and yet everybody seems to have time. Either for me as a foreigner, or for one another, people are perpetually sitting around drinking tea, chatting. So they really do seem to have a lot more time than busy people in Europe, US and Korea, where everybody's got meetings to go to, things to do. But sort of equating time with money, I'm not proposing that humans need to change the time system. I'm suggesting the money system. So again, the two should not really be equated if we want to keep clear about what is possible. Maybe you know people who tell you there's no such thing as a free lunch. Well, this is the George Lakoff strict father idea. That's why you have to fight. That's why you have to be tough, because you're not going to get free lunches. Well, we know that hunter-gatherers think differently about things. And I do know people who live even in the developed country without touching money. Life is actually possible without money, although, of course, the rich would not like us to think that. Money relies on the logic of selfishness. Money is a way for you to get what you want. So if you accept the perpetual propaganda on commercial media that life is about money, then life becomes about getting what you want. This is a strict father idea again. He who pays the piper calls the tune. To the strict father, alienated work is needed. Why? Because there are disciplined people who prosper, end up rich, and indisciplined people who don't and end up poor. And for the natural order of things, along the survival of the fittest lines, the virtuous rich, the disciplined, the intelligent, the hard-working, should be in charge of the indisciplined poor, the great unwashed. So alienated work is necessary to amplify the intelligence and the industry of the virtuous rich. This slide I've called The Cult of Professionalism, and the quote is from L. Ron Hubbard, founder of that modern science fiction religion, Scientology, and he says, "So learn this as a first lesson about life. The only successful beings in any field, including living itself, are those who have a professional viewpoint and make themselves and are professionals." So, what does it mean to be a professional? Well, the root meaning, as far as I'm concerned, is working for money. But there are other meanings. The meaning of highly skillful. The meaning which is put forward by office professional. When that first came out, I remember laughing. It's like, well, what was the other version? Office amateur? Who runs an office for the love of it? But that was Microsoft's contribution to the language. Over time, professional has become a laudatory adjective. Now, if you want to champion something, how good it is, call it professional, and people assume that it's better than non-professional. Then, of course, there's people who behave professionally. You say, she was very professional about it. Then you can use this to explain somebody who disregarded their own personal beliefs in order to satisfy the customer. So you can see how those three different meanings, all coming from the same word professional, what are those three? Working for money, putting customer wishes ahead of your personal beliefs, doing whatever you're paid to do, being alienated, and being highly skillful. Isn't it a confusing thing for those three all to be put under the same word, professional? So what's the take-home message here? Excellence, being highly skillful, means working for money, not love. Being able to alienate yourself from what you're doing. And when you ask, if you meet somebody, what do? You're usually not asking, what are you doing? If I say, what do? I'm asking, what do for money? How do you survive? But just limiting it, what do? People don't often say, I am a mother, I breathe, I listen to the radio. They don't say these things. They say whatever activity they use to gain money. So it validates people's activities and identities. Whatever they're doing, if they're paying paid for it, it becomes a valid activity. Now, this slide is called glorification of hoarding. People talk about making money. It works in many languages. It works in German. It works in Bengali. It works in, I think, most modern languages. You talk about making in with money. You're not talking necessarily about actually creating. You're not talking about engraving plates and stamping and making bills. You're talking about getting more money from other people than you're giving them out. Accumulating money is called making money. And because it's got the same word, then people associate making money, which is taking money off other people, in fact, with doing something like making chairs or making houses or making laptops, with real productive activity. So those who merely hoard money are esteemed as if they were creating real goods and contributing to commonwealth. And all of these misunderstandings, we've seen them reflected in the language, which is, as Lakoff says, intimately connected to people's decision-making and to the structure of their brains. All of these metaphors show the set of reactions which people have to money. I've called this slide Money as Status. There is one smiley on top of a hierarchy of frownies because the guy at the top is rich, which is associated with being good, in the sense of being good at what you do, in the sense of being morally good. You can be proud of being rich. So the rich are seen as hard-working, clever, productive, and according to the strict father model, why are you poor? Well, you're bad in a moral sense and in a sense of capabilities, so it's something to be ashamed of. The poor are lazy, stupid, and consumptive. So Africa, full of lazy, stupid, consumptive people. And if you look at the actual data about how little the poor consume, and how much is consumed by the wealthy, it tells you a very different story. But the language is created as a veneer, as a way to deflect the truth from penetrating people's understanding. Recall Frederick Bastiat's assertion that the rich, the plunderers, create a legal system which permits what they do, and they create a moral code which glorifies it.